You're listening to Community Radio WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, and streaming online around the world at weru.org. And this is Weekend Voices, the community audio magazine produced here at WERU. We are you, and these are your voices. I'm your host, Amy Brown. On today's program, John Greenman brings us excerpts from community members participating in a talking circle held recently on the topic of Martin Luther King and reconciliation. And Marge May talks with Malalai Joya, activist, social worker, member of the Afghan Parliament, and author of the new book, Woman Among Warlords. We start with a conversation about reconciliation.
Last Sunday at the Keith Anderson Community Center in Orono, a group of people came together to talk about love and hate and forgiveness and retribution and reconciliation. Organized by the Peace and Justice Center of Eastern Maine, the university's Peace and Reconciliation Studies program, and students from the University of Maine's Office of Multicultural Programs, the gathering was one of several events designed to remind the community of Martin Luther King's legacy. This was going to be a talking circle about reconciliation, and while Heather Kitchen, graduate assistant with the Office of Multicultural Programs, spelled out a few of the guidelines for how a talking circle works, the circle of filled chairs grew to around 45. People came from area communities, UMaine, and nearby high schools.
And the other thing is, if you feel uncomfortable answering a question, it's okay to just say pass. No judgment here. So feel free to just send it along your way.
Thank you all. And,
Phil Brzee, director of the university's Peace and Reconciliation Studies program, facilitated the sharing.
What we would like to do next, I have a couple of quotes from Dr. King that I would like to read to you, but I'll wait until they get all the way around. And then we'll do a round in terms of an open-ended prompt based on this quote. So as I read it to you, I don't want you to worry about trying to get your thoughts together, but we'll also give you a bit of time to consider how you want to respond. Before I start, one of the things that's been really important to me personally is the whole idea of reconciliation. And the Peace and Reconciliation Studies program changed our name to include that word reconciliation. And as we were doing that, we've realized that that word reconciliation is coming up over and over and over again in so many different ways and in so many different places. And Elise Boulding, who's one of the co-founders, really, of the Peace Studies movement, Peace Studies education movement, said that the 21st century was going to be the century of the reconcilers. So I really took that to heart in our program, just taking that to heart. And as I looked through, preparing for today, looked through material from Dr. King, again, what came up was that word, again, reconciliation, again and again and again. So this is the, I'd like to read the first quote, which is four paragraphs, but there's a couple of other quotes that also use the word reconciliation, so you get another sense of his commitment to this idea of reconciliation. From Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend. We never get rid of an enemy by meeting hate with hate. We get rid of an enemy by getting rid of enmity. By its very nature, hate destroys and tears down. By its very nature, love creates and builds up. Love transforms with redemptive power. We must develop and maintain the capacity to forgive. Whoever is devoid of the power to forgive is devoid of the power to love. It is impossible even to begin the act of loving one's enemies without the prior acceptance of the necessity over and over again of forgiving those who inflict evil and injury upon us. It is also necessary to realize that the forgiving act must also be initiated by the person who has been wronged. The victim of some great hurt, the recipient of some torturous injustice, the absorber of some terrible acts of oppression. The wrongdoer may request forgiveness. They may come to themselves and, like the prodigal son, move up some dusty road, their heart palpitating with the desire for forgiveness. But only the injured neighbor, the loving father back home, can really pour out the warm waters of forgiveness. Forgiveness does not mean ignoring what has been done or putting a false label on an evil act. It means, rather, that the evil act no longer remains as a barrier to the relationship. Forgiveness is a catalyst creating the atmosphere necessary for a fresh start and a new beginning. So what I'd like you to do is just take a moment to formulate some kind of response to this, not knowing how many people, and we've kind of tripled, it feels like, since we started. I had three questions that I was going to use as three rounds. So let me give you those three questions, and they may help you in some kind of response to this quote from Dr. King. The first question was going to be, what does reconciliation mean to you? The second was, what do you see as barriers to reconciliation in your life and or in mainstream society? And the third was, what have you done or are you doing to work on reconciliation? So I'll give you a moment to my word flink, which is to think and to feel. Okay, so you have a moment to reflect. Okay, so I'll start. In my lifetime, really dealing with the idea of what does an enemy mean? And are there some cases where people are unredeemable and unforgivable, and that there never can be any reconciliation? So is there an nth degree in terms of my response to some individual human beings? Looking at history, looking at current events and things that are happening all around the world, and then reading from a lot of different sources, indigenous sources, Buddhist sources, many, many different areas that really have helped me understand that if I don't forgive someone and if I don't reconcile with them as being human, then I am dehumanizing myself. So this whole idea of reconciliation and forgiveness to me is very complex, but maybe elegantly simple at the same time. It's basically looking at the humanity in each person and not letting go of any negative or terrible act, but not framing that person as less than human. And I'm really still struggling a great deal with working with that and using it on a daily basis. But it's out there for me as an ideal. And that's a legacy from my perspective, from Dr. King to me.
See if I can phrase this. I'd like to respond to number two, the barriers that I see from my perspective to reconciliation, and kind of jumping off what Phil said. I teach an EDB 202 class. I teach a multicultural class, so I'm starting to hear some student responses. And I think that I hear the same thing kind of over and over again, year after year. So I guess a barrier would be, for me, would be coming to some kind of awakening that reconciliation is possible. I think some of, and for me, I had to come to that awakening myself. I had to understand that it was possible, and most likely probable. But I think there needs to be almost a mass awakening. I think that people need to start seeing that it's possible, and that the world isn't as awful, I think, as some people or some of the young people that I hear are still kind of in that, you know, kind of in that mindset.
I also want to answer number two. I think a huge barrier is people not being all right with accepting change.
To answer number three, what I've been trying to do for reconciliation, I took one class in mediation, and from that class I learned that the most important thing in trying to resolve issues is to understand both sides. And I think a lot of the time, I guess this is part of number two and number three, a barrier to reconciliation is maybe stubbornness and not being willing to think about what the other person or what the other party is, where they're coming from and what they've been dealing with. I think that's very important. I've been trying to work that into different situations in my life and really think about both sides of the issue before it gets too far.
One thought about what reconciliation is, I associated with the process after the fall of apartheid, where the truth and reconciliation process was initiated. And I think it was important then, and probably in most such processes, that before there can be reconciliation, there has to be an owning up to the injustice. So that's, you can't just talk about people forgiving unless the people they are going to forgive have admitted they're wrong. And second thought having to do with, well, I guess as a white male American citizen, I feel like more often than not, I'm saddled with responsibility for a lot of wrongdoing. And so for me, I'm less concerned with forgiving people that have wronged me than trying to stop some of my fellow citizens from continuing to perpetuate wrongs so that other people don't have anything that they have.
A poem by Leonard Cohen has helped me a lot with forgiveness and reconciling. And ring the bells that still can ring. There is no perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. And I think it's our very mistakes as humans that we may all make that lead us to, as a bridge to our fellow humans, for forgiveness. And it's recognizing that in ourselves and then spreading that forth to others. I find forgiving myself in parts of that step.
I think that forgiving people is a very hard situation for some people, depending on what the other person has done. But I always think that someone should have a second chance in everything.
Just going to add a little bit to what he said. To fear to forgive and when to forgive somebody, like he said, it's pretty much possible to do it, but at the same time, the person which you are trying to forgive, you got to understand and be able to admit their wrongdoing. And pretty much, you guys got to be on the same page.
Well, I think reconciliation is more than forgiveness. I think what Dr. King was alluding to had mostly to do with the change, the legal change of the American slaves into American society. And the American society sort of saying, hey, listen, we're sorry. Listen, what can we do to make it up to you? Now, a lot of things have occurred to bring blacks and whites onto a level playing field. A lot hasn't been done, but it's in process. Now, I find every generation now, since then, is saying, every generation of American blacks, specifically, is saying, hey, listen, we want to be reconciled too. Okay? And mostly that's in form of monetary reconciliation. It might not be true, but this is how I'm seeing it. In the early part of the 20th century, there was a big Ku Klux Klan around in this area specifically. Even back then, there was a lot less blacks, or a lot less of anybody besides whites in this area. So they moved up to religious communities, specifically Catholics and Jewish. And so what are they going to say? Hey, we want to be reconciled? No. I think the biggest community who had the most power, who put down the most people, were the Catholics. I was raised a Catholic, and I've been through a lot of the history books, and who's doing all the killing? The Catholics. Okay, so listen, you know, reconcile yourself first. But I think it's up to each person to understand. I think understanding is the thing that most people have to control. And I think once you understand where another person, another group of people is coming from, then it's up to you to say, hey, listen, you know, let's play on an even field. And I'm talking about now with the gay minorities as well, okay, and the Native American minorities as well. You know, a lot of people have been put down, and it's time to bring them up to a level playing field.
Yeah, all I have to say about reconciliation is that you should definitely do it as soon as possible, because people pass away a lot sooner than you think they might, and then it's too late. Mm.
Those are assumptions, those are choices about how to view the world, and you can make different choices, and that, you know, all you have to do is, I mean, it can get to feel very natural and very true, but they should always be addressed and reassessed.
To me, I guess reconciliation is not so much about forgiving and forgetting as admitting that, like, you wronged someone. And I mean, it's a lot easier to forgive someone who says that they wronged you. So
my idea of reconciliation is more than just forgiveness, because you can't forgive someone, but as you said, you can't forget. And it's letting go of that grudge that it's full reconciliation. And I've learned that through family experiences where family members wronged the entire family, but because we love that person, we gave them a second chance, and we don't assume that they're going to do anything wrong again. And once you can fully let go and fully try and forget, definitely fully give reconciliation to someone else.
I guess the world's like full of so many different things that can just happen within the blink of an eye. And we all walk around thinking about what it might be like. We read on the news, media, and everything about killings and robberies, etc. And in a way, our society is kind of like getting scared and put down, which might cause more crime, etc. And we're left thinking like whether we should forgive people at least or not. Like, what would we do if somebody, instead of being somebody else who just died, it was one of our own family members, somebody close to us who just got killed. And then how do we go towards going through trial when we know who the person is that did this? And it's been just long back going in which you either end up going crazy or forgiving the person who has done this wrong to you. Because just hanging on to it and holding the grudge just makes you feel worse. It throws you down and you can't really get up. It's like having a rock smashing you upside the head. And you just feel that lift right off of you when you make that when you just forgive the person. You stop and you think again to know that, you know, there's a lot of other people out there like that, and that's the only way that they're able to move on with life is by forgiving things that happened in the past and that might even happen in the future. They get ready and embrace themselves for that.
I think reconciliation depends upon a foundation of justice, and I can increasingly believe that love has less to do with reconciliation than justice, and that actually if justice is achieved, love can follow. So for me, I ponder the systems that we have that generate, you know, the mass poverty and oppression. And I look at this issue less as an individual matter. And even if we contextualize the individual wrongs that we experience, they all have their roots in systemic injustice, almost all. So I ponder increasingly how I as an individual can affect change in systems so that people can behave with justice, and that from that justice, love can grow, and from that love, reconciliation.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking as well. That was very well said, I think. Because I struggle with power and injustice when it comes to vulnerable people and myself in terms of personal reconciliation or forgiveness, and very, like you are, concerned about the powerful people and the injustice that occurs on a daily basis to vulnerable people. That's part of the struggle. Understand it, I guess, for me.
I think reconciliation and forgiveness are pretty synonymous. But when you think of forgiveness, I think you have to look at it from two angles, because I think a common discussion of forgiveness would be the one who has been wronged should forgive the person who did the evil. And that's a lot of it. But I also think that the one who is doing the wrong can come to the realization that they are causing harm, or they are being bad to a group or a person or something. And if they realize that, they may look for forgiveness from the person who they have wronged. And I think in both cases, it's important to look through the eyes of the other person. What is their life like? Everyone here has got a certain viewpoint of life and the way they behave and their attitude and prejudices and feelings and things. But I think it's important to get to the point of forgiveness or understanding that you've got to walk in the other guy's shoes for a mile. Because unless you understand where the other person's coming from, it's difficult to truly forgive or understand or have redemption with them. So it's a two-way street. And hopefully the one who's doing the wrong gets to the point where they realize that they're doing it. Like Mike talked about the white American WASP person. has caused all kinds of problems in this country ever since they first stepped ashore with the Spanish, I guess, whoever it was, Italian. They raised havoc with the Native American populations, and then it's kind of gone on and on like that for centuries, really. And now we're doing it all over the world. The United States is, in its arrogance. Mm. And I think we as a country need to really take a hard look at ourselves. And I was so encouraged when Obama was running for office, and it seemed like it was a grassroots support. Everybody, at least in the middle or on the left, was supporting him, where they hadn't really been involved in politics before. And now their hopes and dreams maybe aren't being fulfilled as much as they'd like to see them. But I think it's important for the United States to recognize what they are doing for around the world and ask for forgiveness and try to reconcile with a lot of the situations that we've created.
Your Martin Luther King Jr. talked about the structures that were creating poverty, and those structures were structures that supported lawmaking over human needs. And when I look at what's happening in Haiti, and I wonder how can those people in Haiti forgive all of us for allowing so much money to be spent on lawmaking when that money could have gone to create an infrastructure in that country that could have responded somewhat more humanely to the terrible crisis that's happening there. And how the Iraqi people can forgive all of us for continuing to allow their country to be destroyed and so many of them to be killed, and now the Afghan people. So what I'm doing in terms of working towards structures of more justice is we have a campaign now called Bring the War Dollars Home. And we're going to be working, and if anyone's interested in helping on that, we're going to have a meeting Tuesday night where we're talking about how we can help educate people about how much money, that nearly half of our tax dollar goes to the military, and that we should be using that to meet our needs at home. You know, we're having all these people demonstrating in Augusta because they can't get the services that they desperately need. Well, if we stop wars and militarism, we would have that money. So I'm wondering how all the victims of these policies are going to ever forgive and reconcile unless we help to change those structures.
I don't think really I have much to add from what's been said. People have come from a number of different perspectives, but I think that there's a lot of focus going toward the same goals and the same ends. And I say, let's do it faster rather than slower.
Yeah, I think I'm just hearing a lot of neat things about how we need to reconcile ourselves as a country, to sort of come around to understanding better and educating ourselves more and being more fair and less greedy. And I think there's also this need for me to reconcile something within myself as far as being more educated and understanding as an individual towards diversity.
And I would say for me, what I've been learning is just how much reconciliation begins with me, how I view myself, and then how I view the world and people outside of me. And this story just keeps running through my mind. I think a good quote that I might misquote, actually, from St. Francis says, Lord, may I not so much seek to be understood as to understand. And I have this one particular story of how I was actually in a small group of people. We were having a talking discussion, and something was done where I knew that I had hurt this person's feelings. And so after the discussion time, I went to the individual, and I was saying how I was sorry and explaining myself and everything. And then I went away from that situation, and I realized, oh my gosh, I was so focused on just making sure that my situation was explained that I didn't even really give the other person the chance to share with me how they were hurt or how it affected that individual. And so I just had the unction that, well, I need to go back and apologize again and be willing to hear the pain and the hurt that it caused that individual. So I went back again and apologized again. And it, I mean, I really had to let go of my pride, in a sense, to be willing to do that. So it's not something easy to be done. And I feel like if I can keep learning to do this, because things happen every day. So if I can make it my lifestyle every day and show people and affect people in my little world, then I can start looking to the larger levels and the larger systemic issues in the same sort of way to help affect changing that way.
Speaking about reconciliation from my own experience, I'm a person that is very hard to forgive those that wronged me. Because everyone, it's about what Heather says as well, it's about everyone's pride. Everyone in this room has pride. But with my family, I think we take pride past that barrier to where if something were to happen, we will never admit that we were wrong about it. And as I said, talking about experience, there was, you know, a little incident that kind of broke my entire family apart. And, you know, it weighed down on all of us. And I remember that one day where the two members of my family reconciled with one another. And I remember how all my family members, it just brought tears to their eyes and also mine. And it just shows how much reconciliation works for everyone. So, you know, sometimes you just have to drop your pride if we all want to get along with each other.
I think that sometimes reconciliation is more than forgiving someone. And it's more than seeking forgiveness from someone. Because, you know, to speak for myself, there's a lot of people that I need to seek forgiveness from, and there are a lot of people that I need to forgive. So I think it's important we need to move beyond that stuff and start thinking about what can I do to affect a change where I can prevent someone or a group of people from being wrong like I was. And how can this change that I make help other people not to harm other people like I have?
Being a native in white America has not been easy for me. The only reconciliation that I want is when Obama signs a declaration for the indigenous people, then I'll be happy. I've been in the white man's military. I've lived in a lot of foreign countries. I've seen people being killed for their spiritual and religious beliefs by their military regimes. I've been through a lot. I've seen a lot. I've been shot at. I've protested. The only way people experience something is if they've been there. People who don't experience, they just basically, you know, keep your mouth shut. You know, and the bottom line is, you know, for years, I'm speaking from my own personal experiences. For years, we natives have been fighting for freedom. And for, I don't need the colonial government coming to me and my people saying, well, I'm sorry for what we did to you. That's not going to cut it. You can give all the money you want, ha ha. I mean, it helps, but it doesn't soften, and it doesn't, I don't know what I'm thinking, I want to say. It doesn't, the damages, the killing, the senseless killing and torture of my people have, I could just look and say, okay, well, Calvary, Custer made mistakes, killing innocent children and women. So for me, I think somebody said it earlier, even today, I'm kind of calmed down a little bit, but I will continue to fight for my rights and my freedoms for my indigenous peoples, not just in America, but also in the world. And I believe, not assume, is that in the only way that we are going to work and live in a better environment, safe and secure, is that all nations, red nations, black nations, whatever, we all have to come to work together as a whole. Because a few of us, I get tired, I don't know about you all, I get tired of hearing about the Jewish Holocaust, I get tired of hearing about the black causes and this and that. You know, I understand, but you know what? No one talks about the red man Holocaust, and it really bothers me. Even today, as we're sitting down, people must know their real history, and I'll be quiet, is that back in the old days, the black people were selling their own people for profit. Our people were selling our people for profit. I'm ashamed of that. But I tell you one thing, I'm proud of my allegiance is to my people, my allegiance is to Mother Earth, democracy comes second. I love this country even though it's screwed up. But the bottom line is this country needs to stop being the policeman of the world. It needs to stop. It's violating the United Nations Charter. But like I said, if Obama signs the charter to the indigenous peoples, I'll be happy. But the bottom line is I'm Indian and I'm going to protect my rights, my Indian rights, my native rights, my hunting rights, my fishing rights, my environmental rights, because I don't know about you all, I'm just tired of it. I'm just tired of hearing about the war. I'm tired of hearing about this. And what am I doing about it? I'm speaking. It's you, the non-Indians, have to become students and us be the teachers.
Some of the voices heard in Orono last week at a gathering to consider Martin Luther King's teachings on reconciliation. For WERU, I'm John Greenman.
You're listening to Weekend Voices on WERU. Up next, Marge May talks with activist, social worker, member of the Afghan Parliament, and author Malalai Joya.
Tell us a little bit about your childhood. You lived in Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan. Why was it necessary for you to move so often?
Yeah, because I was 4 days old, baby, that after 4 days I brought Russia occupied Afghanistan. On that time, millions of Afghans, they became refugees. In the meantime, that they killed millions of Afghans, and also Democrats, justice-loving people of my country, all of these freedom-loving fighters. And but those who become refugees because of the disastrous situation of our country, that Russia and their puppets, they come in power and they killed innocent people of my country as well. And in the meantime, for Democrat people, freedom-loving fighters, was too much risky. But when we went first to Iran, because Hefara province is close to Iran, and that's why we became refugee first to Iran. Then from Iran, after 3 years that we spent there, we went to Pakistan. And in 98, when I finished school in refugee camps of Pakistan, we with my family, we went in Herat province in the west of Afghanistan as underground activists for girls and women that in the period of Taliban was no education. It was what briefly that I told you about.
I think you were clear in what you told us about why you had to move around so much as a child. Could you tell us a little about your connection with the organization of promoting Afghan women's capabilities, OPOC? When did you first become involved with them?
Yes, it's like a non-governmental organization that they had in the period of Taliban, mainly education activities for women and girls, because there was no education in the period of Taliban for women and girls. And also today they have some project as well that for their project is health and education activities for women and children, because they believe that women and children during the war, they were the most and also the first victims, and still many violences against them. In 1998, on that time, this NGO was not even registered, but they started their activities. And for me, it was like a first experience that I saw working with them and as a to work with the NGO before. Just I was teacher for literacy courses in refugees camps like that. And then I became director of this NGO that in the west of Afghanistan, and mainly in Herat and Farah and Zabul province, they had projects. So close contact with my people, I had that in faraway villages and district on behalf of this NGO. We went and we have a clinic in Farah province that I established. That clinic, the story you can read in my book, that how much it was difficult, especially for a young girl, that to stand up and to be social activist because of these local warlords who are in power. And not only they do not support, in the meantime, they create lots of problem and threat to death and so many problems like that. But I was so glad and happy that my people didn't leave me alone, and all of these stories you can read in the book as well. And the reason that they voted me in 2003, as I was the youngest one on that time, a main candidate.
Because and you're talking about the lawyer Jirga?
Yeah, before of Lloyd Jirga, as you said, about the activities of OPOC. The reason that for the first time in 2003 for Lloyd Jirga election, that when we made constitution, I became the first winner. The main reason was the activities of the OPOC, as I had close contact on behalf of them with the suffering people, innocent people, especially women and children, in faraway district and villages of Farah, and also in the center of Farah. But today, day by day, they are losing their project. Even because of me, they lost some of their project after when I stand up against these warlords, these drug lords who are photocopy of Taliban, and I expose their mask, and still they are in power. So now I cannot work anymore with them, but I'm trying to support them through my supporter from outside of Afghanistan, foreign supporters.
And you were elected to the parliament in 2005. What happened there? Why were you banished?
Yeah, it was for the second time that I ran for parliamentary election, because on that time I became famous not only in my country, around the world, justice-loving people, democratic-minded people of the U.S. and also around the world, they know about me. As the election was quite non-democratic election, all the boxes was in the hands of mafia. As a famous saying, it's not important who is voting, it's important who is counting. That's our problem. But they allow for few Democrats and real representatives to find way in parliament because of the showcase of their democracy. Because of this mockery of democracy. And I thought with myself that it's good to run, if I win, to be the small voice of the voiceless people of my country in the parliament. And that just they showed their power to my people and to me in the meantime. And anyway, but I found when Lloyd Jirga, and you saw that they couldn't tolerate, I found when parliament, they couldn't tolerate me in parliament, they turned off microphone, they treat me to death. Even they beat at me, they threatened me to rape even inside of parliament. Finally, they did censor one of my interview on May 2 years before, and as a political conspiracy used it against me, which is quite a legal act and anti-freedom of speech.
Malalai, your name, Malalai Joya, is not the name that you were born with. You changed it at some point. Why did you do that, and why did you choose Joya?
Yeah, Malala is the name that name of one of the heroine of Afghanistan. Like we have Malala of Maywand, she was from Kandahar, and she has a great story you can read in my book, that she inspires many other Afghan, I'm sure even other activists around the world. Because these heroines not only belongs to their countries, and like the other hero and heroine around the world. And many other hero also we had, like Mina, Nahid, Wajia, Ghobar, Sawa, Joya, etc. But that's why my family choose the name of Malalai they put on me, because they proud for Malalai of my one. In Afghanistan, you can find many Malalais when you go there. But Joya is the name of one of the freedom-loving fighters in Afghanistan that I really liked it. And when I become activist in the period of Taliban, I choose this this name. For security reasons also was good, and I loved really this name, and my family was not like, especially my father is a Democrat, it was not a matter for them that, as always, he wants that woman to have their, and he believes that women, they must have their own identity. Anyway, I love this name, and this two name of these freedom-loving fighters of my country inspires, and we are following their path of democracy, women's rights, human rights in our country.
Now, one thing that comes across in your book that I don't think really people may know about, just from hearing about what you do or reading about what you do in the newspapers, what comes across in your book is that your people, ordinary Afghans, really, really support you. What could you tell us about that? What have you found as you've done your work in Afghanistan? How have your people responded to you, aside from the warlords?
You know, day by day, by strong support of these most of suffer, very poor, innocent people of my country. In the meantime, justice-loving people, democratic-minded people, in some parties we have more than party intellectuals. Through their support, I understand how much I'm right, and also day by day, what I said, everything is coming true. Not only me, many other justice-loving Democrat people in my country, that especially after 9/11, U.S. government and NATO, they pushed us from the frying pan into the fire, and they brought in power these warlords who are photocopy of the Taliban, these drug lords. We raised our voice against that, but nobody listened our voice. But when in 2003 I stand up against these misogynists, the warlords, that's when my life has been changed. And what I said, that these criminals, these bunch of killers, that as always I'm saying, these are just a bunch of names full of shame in the history of my country. And my people hate them. They are like two of them right now, assistants of Hamid Karzai, like Karim Khalili and Qasim Fahim. Even Human Rights Watch said during the election that Karzai insulted the people of Afghanistan. He chose these two criminals. They did civil war in Afghanistan from 92 to 96. And many other like these two cruel men that who are leaders of these fundamentalist parties, like Dostum, like Ismail Khan, Mohake, Kanuni, Abdullah, and Golabzoi, Ulumi, and these are, etc. A few more names that you can see in Human Rights Watch website, Amnesty International website, that they committed crimes, same like Taliban, leaders of Taliban, and leaders of puppet of Russia. We call them Khalkin Parchami. So they, unfortunately, day by day, getting more powerful. What I said, that they must be, they must bring them to the national, international criminal court. If really U.S. government and in NATO, honest for Afghan people, give us helping hand to bring them to the court, not to support them. And day by day, they make arm them, and still do not stop arming them. And that's why people support me, they agree with me, and day by day they do more support. And today that I'm changing the houses in Afghanistan, safe house to safe houses, and it's an example of solidarity of my people. They are not my family and my relative, all of them. And also that right now, the reason, main reason I'm alive, because of strong support of these poor, suffer people of my country. and even if I'm today famous because of their support, and some journalists even who was during the Loiger 2003, that when they met me, these foreign journalists tell me, Melanie, we were there and we saw the love and solidarity of your people, that how much they loved you, they agree with you, and it's still that when I meet my people, especially young generation in outside of the country, and some conferences I attend, not only in Afghanistan, they hug me and they cry. And yet last night also one young Afghan girl I met, and she was crying, and she was telling me it was one of my dreams to meet you, because they are agree, and they are what generation, and their family telling them as justice loving people. In Afghanistan also, those victim girls and family I met them, they come. Some clips on my webpage also, you can see that they are agree and they support, and also students of universities, especially intellectuals and these war generation, that they saw nothing in their life, and also innocent people of my country and Democrat people of my country, old generation, they support. But these are only this bunch of killers who are in power, and they are the one who want to eliminate me because I'm woman. I never do compromise with them. I'm exposing their crimes, and I'm telling the truth. That's why even they expelled me from parliament, which is quite a legal act. They banned me from media. Many propaganda raising against me to change the mind of my people against me. Also, they took my diplomatic passport. And this is ordinary passport that I'm traveling with lots of problem by burqa, coming to another country by car. And from there, I have flight with so many problems to bring the message of my people to justice-loving, great people of the U.S. and around the world. As always, people are separate from the wrong policymakers, those who do dirty business with politics. And I'm honored that Democrat people, justice-loving people in U.S., when I was for 2 weeks there because of launching of the book in different cities of the U.S. and also now in Canada, through their support also, day by day, I understand how much I'm right and gives us more hope and courage. Anyway, I think these warlords, with all of these risks that they create, not only for me, for other people of my country, and they want to eliminate me, this is their political weakness.
You've talked about the government of your country. What should the United States and other Western governments do to promote real peace in your country?
You know, I think this 8 years is enough to know better about these bunch of puppets like Khalilzad, and also that Hamid Karzai, you mentioned the name, and many other who are around Hamid Karzai. At least recently, New York Times wrote that brother of Hamid Karzai, Ahmad Wali Karzai, is a famous drug trafficker and receiving millions of dollars from CIA. My people call him Small Bush in Kandahar province. And many other Bush are in power in my country, and my people hate them. They are still getting powerful. As always, I'm saying, only the name of terrorist of Afghanistan for the terrorist of the world is different. They are like Pinochet, Franco, Mussolini, Suharto, Hitler, etc. But with the mask of democracy, they are in power. And after 9/11, physically has been changed, these warlords. Who are mentally same like Taliban, and they come in power. That's why situation, not only for the people, all people, especially for the women in most of provinces like hell. They under the banner of women rights, human rights, occupied my country. And now situation for women day by day getting worse because of these misogynist warlords who are in power. Also Taliban, together they continue to their fascism against women. As today, rape cases, acid attacks, domestic violence, kidnapping of women increasing rapidly. And all of these crimes are happening under the name of democracy. So if really Mr. Obama honest for Afghan people, I think this 8 years is enough to know better about Karzai's, this mafia corrupt system. And secondly, first of all, he must apologize to my people and criticize the wrong policy of criminal Bush. At least, first of all, he must try to bring this Bush to the International Criminal Court for the war crime he committed. And he, Mr. Obama, if really honest for Afghan people, he must end this tragic drama of so-called war on terror, which is war on innocent civilians, means end occupation. Second, he must stop arming these warlords, not negotiate with Taliban, as now Mr. Obama declared barbaric Taliban as a moderate to bring them also in power, while we have no moderate Talib. And this fascist man, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who is in power, who is right now, Karzai invite him many times to join the government and come in power. And Mr. Obama must raise the voice against that. And also that if really Mr. Obama honest for Afghan people, he must support democratic-minded, justice-loving people of my country. While like your country and other countries around the world, we have a lot. Some Democrat Party we have is still there, underground activists, modern parties, intellectuals. There is no honorable job for them. Everyone who say the truth, who stand up against these warlords, this mafia system, they receive death threats as first casualty is the truth. And also, if really Mr. Obama honest for Afghan people, together with UN, he must stop neighbor countries like Iran, Pakistan, Russia, Uzbekistan, etc., who support Taliban and also these warlords. But unfortunately, foreign policy of Mr. Obama is quite similar like Bush. He surge more troops in Afghanistan, which will bring more conflict, more war. And he start war in Pakistan as well. At least situation of Iraq and Afghanistan is enough to know democracy never come by war, by barrel of gun, by cluster bomb. Now my people is squashed between two powerful enemies, external enemies and internal enemies. With the withdrawal of one enemy, these occupation and occupation forces, it's much easier to fight against one enemy instead of two. But my message to great people of U.S. is that when we say your government must end the occupation and let us breathe a little bit in peace, if they let us to breathe a little bit in peace, then we know what to do with our destiny. But you are the one, as justice-loving people of the U.S., great people of the U.S. and also around the world, human rights activists and organizations, anti-war movement and intellectuals, you must join your hands with us and do not leave us alone for this risky and prolonged struggle.
Well, Malalai, thank you very much. It's very good to talk to you. Do you have any parting thoughts for people in the U.S.?
Yeah, my message to great people of the U.S. is that I think you also agree with us that democracy never come by war and no nation can donate liberation to another nation. But no question, we need your helping hand as much as you can. We need your solidarity and support. First of all, please raise your voice against the wrong policy of your government. On behalf of my people, I say condolences to those suffer mom of American mom and also and NATO moms who lost their son and daughter in Afghanistan. I said condolences, but I told them, please change your tears and your sorrows to their strength and raise your voice against the wrong policy of your government that do not send more taxpayer money to such a mafia system, corrupt system, and also do not waste more the blood of their soldier in Afghanistan by support of these warlords and now negotiating with Taliban. And join your hands with us as much as you can because the U.S. government and NATO, they occupied my country because of their own strategic, regional, and economic interest. And our history showed we never accept occupation. Now your government says war of Afghanistan is good war of Iraq is bad war. I don't know what is the difference between the word of war. In this kind of situation, disastrous situation, as I told you a few examples, that the so-called free election were held in Afghanistan, that even my people use this power that the winner of this election will be like the same donkey, but with new saddle. And as I said that earlier, all the boxes in the hands of mafia, and you saw that the winner, again, this shameless puppet man, Hamid Karzai, was. And right now, he invites Gulbuddin and Mullah Omar also to join the government. Situation will be more disaster, more bloody, especially for the women. So we need your practical support, especially we need your educational support for some democratic parties and also intellectuals in our country and against occupation. And let me say at the end, the quote of freedom-loving hero of U.S., like Dr. Martin Luther King, he says that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in realities. This is why right, temporarily defeated, is stronger than ever triumphant. One day we will win, but please do not leave us alone.
That was Marge May speaking with Malalai Joya. You can hear more of Marge May's interviews on Women's Windows, which airs Sunday evenings from 8 to 10 o'clock here on WERU. And that's Weekend Voices for today. Voices is a community audio magazine produced here at WERU. You can catch the weekday edition on Tuesday afternoons at 4, in addition to this weekend edition that airs on Saturday mornings at 10. Contributing producers today were John Greenman and Marge May. I'm Amy Brown. Please send story ideas and feedback to news@weru.org, and thanks for listening.